This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Today on Dreamland, we have a guest who has been with us before, is an extraordinary guest. She is an expert on many, many different things. She did her PhD at the University of Missouri, her postdoctoral research at Cornell. She has been an academic in most of her life. She worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Aerospace Center in satellite photography. She has worked at the Battelle Memorial Institute and has been an astronomer at the Ohio State University Radio Observatory. And with that kind of a background, you would think, is this going to be something about intelligence work? And you would not be entirely wrong, but not entirely right. We are going to be talking to Dr. Irina Scott
McCammon.
We're going to be talking to Dr. Irina McCammon Scott, Aliens and the Apocalypse. Irina, welcome back to Dreamland.
Well, thank you. I'm very honored to be here, as I said before, and thank you very much for having me.
Well, Aliens and the Apocalypse is a departure. You are, and yet not at the same time. It is, let me do this. I want you to give us an idea about why you wrote this book, and then I'm going to get into some deeper questions, and I've got quite a few. Now, I guess the best start is, why did you write, what inspired you to write about potential end times and its connection to ancient prophecies and modern phenomena, because that's essentially where we are here?
Well, one thing is the book I wrote with Philip Mantle about Beyond Reasonable Doubt about the Pascagoula incident, and that happened in 1973, which is about 50 years ago. At that time, there was a lot of turmoil, such as government scandals, such as Watergate and impeachment of the president, and the possibility of nuclear war. And they actually had a DEFCON 3 alert, which has only been done twice, and the other one was the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so things sort of died down. Nobody was talking about nuclear war, or there weren't any wars going on. There were a big war in 1973, the Yom Kippur War with Israel, and that was what led to the nuclear alert. Well, now, 50 years later, suddenly there's another war with Israel. There's impeachments, two impeachments. There's a big scandal and other things such as January 6th and wars in Europe and the possibility of nuclear war again. And so things have sort of died down for 50 years and started up again. And that had one thing to do with it. I was just saying that the times don't go away. They sort of come back. And the other thing is that in general, the way we solve our problems may be making our problems worse. And we sort of got over that for a while, but it may be coming back. And people are actually talking about nuclear annihilation, that sort of thing now. So that, in general, is why I wrote it. Part of my inspiration.
Okay, so you're looking at this era that we are in. It has a very climactic feel to it in a lot of ways. The human population has grown very large, maybe larger than the planet can sustain. We have the appearance of these, of what I call the visitors, these strange manifestations that appear to be aliens from another world on the one hand, but when you look at it closely, it gets much stranger. And now you're looking and very much at a strongly feminist view of the origins of life and we look upon evolution as it's very masculine, very Darwinian. It's a winner take all fight to the death. May the best man win approach. But that's not what you say actually goes on in the past, is it? Not at all.
No, I was trying to present it as not saying it's feminist, saying this is a logical view based on the evidence. And today, we've always had predictions of the end ever since, you know, way, way back. And we've always attributed this to external things like a meteor hitting or a volcano or a plague or disease or something. But one thing that's happened recently is that we can destroy ourselves. And this is a big problem, maybe a bigger problem than anything else we can solve. And so that's why I was tying that to the end times.
But, you know, another thing that I found fascinating is this sentence. There might be many reasons why aliens may appear as female. And I hadn't thought of that. But, of course, if you look at the literature, mostly people experience female beings. I certainly did. I was kind of overwhelmed by the power, the feminine power of the being I first encountered and in my experience in 1985. And tell us a little bit about why it may be that these encounters have this feminine quality to it of an extremely powerful feminine presence that's in control and has perhaps non-feminine but also ambiguous helpers and servants. Like, I would say that my impression of what happened to me was there was one female in control, a number of other feminine beings that were sort of independent, and then a group of kind of drone-like beings, but there were no men, none. And I looked through the literature, like in the Communion Letters, and it's almost no one says that they are encountering males. Why is this?
I don't know. One thing, well, I mean, in my book, I answer the reason why is because I think in evolution, nobody knows it and nobody expresses it, but the cooperation is much more important than competitive, do or die, that sort of thing. But I was also saying, so far as what people think the visitors are like, when we go to other planets, we have big men with spacesuits and gas masks and the whole thing. And when one of our society takes over one that's less developed, well, they have conquistador things where they go out and spear and kill and everything else and take gold and whatever. And so we have a natural fear of we may be taken over by other beings. And if they're like us, we expect weapons, but big males, you know, spacesuits and everything. But that's not what we generally see. I mean, I'm not saying we know what they look like. I'm just saying that the appearance in our art and our media is of females. And for instance, the whole idea of UFOs as vehicles with pilots, alien pilots and all that, sort of came in with Roswell. And if you look at the sculptures of bodies of aliens at Roswell, which I had pictures of, they look female. But a lot of the other alien images, such as the Greys and the ones in Close Encounter of the First Kind or whatever, Third Kind, look females. They're female size. They're not wearing gas masks or anything like we would. they're not wearing clothes, which, you know, protect us. And also we use for identity. They're oftentimes not wearing clothes at all. They're skinny little things with big heads. And they don't look like, you know, we would picture in our type of a society as powerful beings that come in and take over physically. They're more like little skinny women or kids.
One of the things you say in the book is that the goddess is much older than any of the male gods. Her religion came from the tradition of a peaceful creator. What happened here? Because it's very clear from the archaeological record that this planet, the very earliest civilizations were goddess-centered. Now they're not. We're very much patriarchal and God-centered and very warlike. And I'm wondering, was there something, some kind of an intervention here that changed the picture? What happened, do you think?
Well, I think in general, women started such a strong society that the men could take over, but I don't know if that's permanent or something that can cause trouble. What I was saying was scientifically, and I've done research and papers on the way mammals develop socially. People have the opinion that groups of animals, I mean, if they have a group of females and a male in the group, well, this is a male harem, and the male put them together and, you know, controls them and everything else. And that's the general opinion from the from books by authors which wrote about the killer ape and how men came down from the trees and then picked up rocks and started killing everything, and that's what created us, was this killer ape and all that. Many books have been written about that, and it's spread widely in the media that that's how it, we developed, and that's what made it us successful. But it's not based on very much evidence at all. The evidence basically is they found bones of people and animals together, and so people, the people concluded, the writers and things, that therefore this is because the people killed the animals, and that's how we overcame everything and made us great. Well, it doesn't exactly agree with the evidence that they have, because if you look in our art, and humans go back to about 200,000 years, and 200,000 years, the art shows females. And during most of the time humans have been on Earth, they've shown females. I mean, like the very first art they found was a statue of a female that somebody carved. And most of the art from then on until maybe about 5,000 years ago was of females. And this is typical of the way mammals develop. They develop as not as male harems, but as groups of females that form the society. And like a lion pride, for example, is a group of female lions with grandmothers and great-grandmothers and offspring and everything else. And there's the male in the group is temporary. He'll be replaced shortly, and then another male comes in. They're not they're not a male harem. They're a group of females with female leaders, female permanent members, and everything else. And that's the way most animal societies are formed.
And it would appear to me to be the way the visitor society is formed, frankly. Because that fits my experience of them very well. And speaking of experience, Free Dreamlanders, you're going to have a great experience right now. We're talking to Dr. Irina McCammon Scott. Her website is irinascott.com. Her new book is Aliens and the Apocalypse. And I was just beginning, it seems to me that if I'm right in my experience and in the experiences of so many other people I have been involved with, the visitors have a very much of a society that's like the society, the human society you're describing from the distant past. And I keep wondering why it changed and why it's different here, because I'm not so sure that the journey we have taken under the leadership of a male in a male-dominated society is ultimately going to work out for us. We seem to be in a pretty bad situation. And would we be in a better situation, a more stable situation, if that had not happened? And why did it happen? Irina, do you know?
Well, I think it's something that happens, would happen in animal societies too. I mean, nearly all animal societies are female groups that have males that come in temporarily and then are evicted by other males. I think what happened with our society is that females developed such a strong society. Well, in a normal animal society, though, the males don't take over, because the females protect the young. In fact, I mean, many females will even sacrifice and kill themselves to protect the young. And this makes the next generation and helps it survive. If there's a lot of males, they're competing with the young and not protecting them, and that weakens the offspring. And so male dominance in an animal society wouldn't last very long, because it wouldn't weaken them directly, but it'd weaken their offspring. But at this time, female humans have developed such a very strong society that they can take male dominance for now. But there's a whole lot of things that can go wrong with male dominance, and it's probably not why it's the standard in animal society.
Yeah, well, it can go wrong, because what happens when there's no balance is something tips, and we've tipped into a hyper-aggressive state of the planet. When I remember talking to Edgar Mitchell about his experience that led to his creation of the Institute for Noetic Sciences, and he said, I couldn't see any borders anywhere. I just saw the planet. And I felt that the planet was profoundly alone and bearing us, and that that relationship was what mattered the most. And yet, when I came home, I became an American again. And there's something there, because this division of mankind into all of these different peoples and places is diminishing us greatly. I mean, we've got all these languages. We've got, and it's wonderful. The cultural diversity is beautiful, but it's also a hindrance in some ways. I'd like to talk now, I'd like to shift, you've got a fascinating chapter on something me and my group of listeners are fascinated by, which is owls. We had Mike Cleland on recently on the show, and of course he is the expert on this relationship, but you've got some very interesting things to say about the relationship between the close encounter experience and owls. And of course, as you point out, I did a lot of wrestling with owls, in my experience, because the first thing I remembered was seeing an owl in the house, which was impossible. That was the beginning of my whole life in this. Tell us what you think about owls and their relationship to the experience.
Well, I had a relationship with an owl too, but it wasn't like yours. When I was about 5 years old, we had real owls in the barn, and I was just fascinated by them. It was my uncle's barn, and was climbing around, and my relatives were out in the field, and they heard this crash in the barn. They wondered what was going on and came, and there my body was. I'd broken a hay rack and everything else and fallen through the barn somehow. They picked me up and carried me out, and I guess eventually I came too. But that was my experience with owls. But I was talking, your experience was a lot different. I was talking about owls as sort of like spiritual beings, and they've been in our literature for, in the art, I mean, way before we had literature, in the art for way, way back. And what today they have the idea of ancient aliens, that what we would call elves and fairies and things like that, back before anybody heard of UFOs, were often depicted as spiritual beings. And a lot of the art is of spiritual beings, probably, if you interpret the art. And a lot of that is with big eyes and things that look like owls. And there was the owl goddess, and there's been a book written about the owl goddess in quite a bit, but a lot of our ancient art is about owls. And it looks just like aliens today, and it looks like the cover of a famous book called Communion, where there's a being there with big eyes. And that symbol, I think, is, I mean, a lot of people saw your book cover and instantly bought the book and recognized it. But I think that symbol's been with us for a very, very long time. And it was called the Eye Goddess back before there was writing or anything, when there just art. The Eye Goddess and the owl have been important symbols in humanity for a very long time.
Julian Jaynes, in his book, The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, talks a lot about the eye goddess and the power of those eyes. And of course, I experienced that in the communion experience, because what I came away with was eyes that I could only relate to an owl. Now, this the eyes, they go back. I mean, the owl it goes back so far. I mean, it goes back into the caves. And as you point out, it's possible that the owl, because owls walk on 2 feet and they fly, of course, too, and they have those faces that look faintly human in a very dramatic way, that the people of the distant past may have thought of them as a different form of human being. And of course, if the visitors were here then too, they would have in a sense been right. Because, you know, my first few weeks of my remembering this experience, I couldn't differentiate between what had actually been there and an owl. It was very mixed up in my mind. I couldn't understand what had happened to me, in part because I couldn't understand how an owl could have done that. It was very confused, as you can imagine. But where did, do you think the visitors were here in the distant past? And people in those days had the same kind of confusion?
Well, the owl, in some ways, it's a lot different from a regular bird, because in order to fly and avoid branches and not crash and everything, you need to see. Well, nearly all birds are out in the daytime. The owls are different because they're out at night. And they fly through fields and, I mean, through woods and things like that. And avoid the obstacles. And man, I mean, when I see owls in the woods, I'm amazed, because a lot of birds, big birds like that, fly up above, but owls will go right through the woods. Well, when I see them in the daytime, I suppose that's what they do at night too. And that's one thing that's different from birds, the rest of the birds. Another thing is, like you said, they look like people and they have big eyes like aliens, and yes, they walk on two legs. And they've actually put pictures of baby owls on the internet and said these are aliens. They're little things walking around looking like aliens. But
the owls are so strange looking. We have to take another break now. We'll be right back. We're talking to Dr. Irina McCammon, Scott, Aliens and the Apocalypse, The Meaning of Alien Messages. And this message, the message of, that's a visual message relating them to owls, is very important because they, you know, the owl is a predator who can dig into a little burrow underground because his sensitive ears and her incredible strong claws, she can actually hear the little chipmunks and so forth running around in their burrows at night, and can go down and rip into the burrow and pull them out. Now, my burrow got ripped into and I got pulled out. That happened late. And I'm not a chipmunk, I don't think. And that wasn't an owl that did it. But what do you make of the connection here? It's a symbolic connection and a sense of connection in nature. And it tells me that our visitors are in some sense a predator. It's like an owl. Can you riff on that at all?
Yeah. If you go back in history and look at cave paintings and drawings, a lot of the times the interpreters today don't know whether they're owls or people because of walking on two legs and the whole thing. And then also this image also is of the deity, whatever deity they had at that time. And so they're mixed up in way, way back too. And so you don't really not actually... Today we think we know everything with science, but we don't know what reality is. We just think in, as I mentioned in my book a number of times, we think in symbols, and this represents reality. Like, for example, you mentioned Julian James, and he was talking about our consciousness and the way we think. And the way we think is that if you picture yourself in a room reading a book, you don't really picture yourself there reading a book. What you picture is a bird's eye view of yourself. You picture yourself walking in the room, picking up the book and reading like you're somebody else. You're not yourself, you're external. And that's sort of the way we think in symbols. We can view ourselves from the outside. And this may have something to do with the owls and things is pulling ourselves out of ourselves, like you said. Yeah, I don't know about predators or not, because people are doing a pretty good job of killing all kinds of things, including ourselves. And so I wouldn't say an owl, I mean, they're a predator, but we do some pretty awful things too.
We, yeah, you know, I think I wasn't going to discuss too much about the Pascagoula incident, but I do want to do that, actually, because you are one of the great experts on this extraordinary UFO case, and it's probably the best, one of the best abduction cases ever recorded. I like to think mine is very convincing, too, and others are as well. But this is a remarkable case, and what makes it so remarkable is that it happened in a much larger context. We concentrate just on the case itself, two men taken aboard a UFO and frightened out of their wits. But there was a much larger event. Can you take us back to 1973 and to what was happening in the world in terms of encounters at that time. And then we're going to talk about the alien in the UFO and exactly what this being was like. But first, let's build a picture, if you will, of the world then with the tremendous explosion that occurred with all of the UFO activity, the upheavals in our society. 1973 was quite a time.
Yeah, that was approximately 50 years ago. And there were many things happening. The Pascagoula abduction made big news. And that was surprising because there were so many other things going on. For example, there was the impeachment and the scandal in Washington of the Nixon scandal and Watergate and all that. Also, there was the Yom Kippur War of Israel and the DEFCON 3 nuclear alert that nuclear war is impending. It may happen any time. And they had all these ties between different governments. One's attacked, the other one attacks and all that. So there was a real possibility of war. There was also a huge UFO wave. And now it's 50 years later. There was relative peace in between. Nobody was talking much about nuclear war. And suddenly now, which is about 50 years later, there's the same thing. There's presidential impeachments. There's scandals such as January 6th. There's war in Europe, which hasn't happened for a long time. The Ukraine war. And also there's a war in Israel. There's talk about nuclear weapons again. And it's like things repeated over 50 years. And another thing was that sound. And that was something I experienced myself. And so it's like things were peaceful and everybody thought everything was fine. And now the same problems are appearing that just like it went through a cycle. And 50 years later, here we are in kind of the same situation.
Well, yeah, but tell us about the sound, because the sound was it was huge. It was an extraordinary event. Tell us what you found out about that sound and when it occurred and so on and so forth.
Well, it first came to my attention because at that time, same time as the abduction, but I didn't know it then, my parents had called me. I was in Missouri and they were in Ohio, which was 600 miles away. And my mother called and said, "Did you hear that explosion?" And I told her she was crazy and joked about it because I couldn't hear anything from Ohio, 600 miles away. She called later, several days later, and said there was this huge UFO invasion type thing of people staying in, keeping their kids in, hiding in the basement and everything else. And one of her friends was chased by a UFO. She wasn't a believer or anything like that. She was a skeptic. So that was odd. So many years later, I decided to look up if I could find when that call came in. And I did find it. And it was the same time as the Pascagoula abduction, but I didn't pay attention to that. Instead, I was interested in the sound, and I started doing research. The state seismologist from Ohio contacted me and helped me find seismographs and things. And I wrote it up in the scientific literature as an unexplained sound. Well, then I published the book with Philip Mantle, and he started investigating the Pascagoula abduction, and it turned out the sound that my parents had called me about way, way back was happened same time as the abduction, which was interesting. And then he wanted me to interview witnesses. And so far as Pascagoula now, we have it's probably the best documented of any abduction account ever. But also there was this sound, and at the same time, and we called our book Beyond Reasonable Doubt, because there might be enough evidence to convince a jury that something happened with the abduction, but the sound might actually convinced scientists that something unusual happened.
You said the last time you were on Dreamland that this might have been the loudest sound ever recorded.
I don't know if it was the loudest, but I think it was probably, it covered a huge area. It covered from, the actual audible sound that people heard, not just vibrations and things. It covered from Iowa to, it went past Washington, D.C. to the coast. And this was a real sound that people heard. It was widespread, and it was picked up by two seismographs, which is pretty unusual. I think it was the most widespread audible sound that on record. But it was also, sounds such as, they've studied sonic booms now, and if an airplane goes over and makes a sonic boom, they know how far the sonic boom will come from the airplane. And it depends on the height. So that if a low airplane makes a sonic boom, it makes a smaller one. If it's higher, it makes a larger one. Like if it's at 80,000 feet, it will make a sonic boom of about 80 miles or 40 on each side. Well, this was interpreted, first of all, as a sonic boom, but it was way, way, way larger than a sonic boom because it may have been heard from New York into Tennessee. And its width, I kind of estimated its height, and that would be about 50 miles. And at 50 miles, you wouldn't hear anything because there's no air up there. So
yeah, that was just going to ask, what produced the sound? Do you know?
No, because it didn't go along with the laws of physics, because by the laws of physics, if you're up high enough to make that wide a sound, you would be so high, nobody would hear it to start with. Well, this had
atmosphere to carry sound waves.
No, but this was such that people were reporting an immediate explosion, like my mother. And over a wide area of the country, it traveled from Iowa to the coast. And there was two seismographs, and I could calculate the speed, and it was approximately three times the speed of sound. But it was very wide, too. And at that distance, you wouldn't hear it. But instead, at that time, there were sonic booms from planes, but this just stood out because there were newspaper reports all the way across the country at different times saying everybody contacted the police and the fire departments and everything else, and the fire departments actually made runs, and people thought there was an immediate explosion right there. Yeah. It shattered windows in different places, things like that, which it obviously wouldn't do at that height. So it made no sense at all, so far as physical principles.
Well, you know, this was in, what year was this? In 1973, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Now, was it heard in New York City?
It was heard in, it wasn't heard in New York City that I got reports from, but it was heard in, I think it was called Binghamton or something that I can't pronounce.
Yeah,
and
because I think it did hit New York City. I lived in New York City.
What
time was it?
It was 1973, October the 11th. And it was around 9 o'clock.
In the morning?
No, at night.
At night. You know, I have a vague memory of something like that. And, you know, the last time we talked, I thought I should have brought that up. And I'm bringing it up now, folks, because if you lived in New York City or anywhere around there in those days, in that time period, look back and see if you can remember it, because I wish Anne was still with me. She would have remembered it very clearly. She had a terrific memory for anything like that, anything unusual. She would file things away, and I have a tendency to blow things off, unfortunately. And But I would swear that there was something that happened that we thought was a sonic boom. We thought, well, that's what it was.
Yeah, registered on a seismograph there, but it also registered up in an Air Force base by the Finger Lakes. I mean, there was just a report of something happening then.
Well, it's an interesting question because I think I might have heard it. Okay, I can't be absolutely sure.
If you have any data or anything on that, let me know.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I could find it, how I could find any, because it must. I do know that it wasn't earth shattering. In other words, it must have sounded enough like a sonic boom for me to be only vaguely aware of it. Because a sonic boom, of course, you don't hear sonic booms over New York City, but you can. I mean, I have heard some explosions or maybe a lightning strike or something. I don't really remember, but maybe we could find out. I mean, we could find out if it was, I could look in old newspapers and so forth and the newspaper archive and see if there are any reports of it. But the important thing is this. The sound was created by something we don't understand. And then there were UFO sightings all over the place. There was a huge UFO wave right at that same time, wasn't there?
Yeah, plus abductions and strange abductions. And
tell us a little bit more about the abductions. But, you know, actually, we've reached a sad point in the show. It's time for me to say goodbye to our free listeners and to move on down the road with our subscribers. So, free listeners, thank you so much, as always, for listening. As always, I urge you to subscribe. Now is the time. We're talking to Dr. Irina McCammon-Scott. Her new book, Aliens and the Apocalypse, you can get it from the unknowncountry.com store. You can visit Irina at irinascott.com. And Irina, tell us a little bit about some of the abductions other than the Pascagoula case that you have knowledge of.
Well, the Pascagoula is interesting also because happened to these two people, but there were other people on the other side of the river. And I talked to the woman for a year or so. She kept saying something strange happened. She saw this thing flying around, but she didn't know what it was. And they were on the other side of the river from the abduction when it happened. And we didn't contact her. One of her kids mentioned it to us. But then after... her husband was a real skeptic, but then several years later, and she just had this feeling something happened, and she described, you know, terror and things like that. And she also had missing time, but she didn't seem to pay attention to that. But then her husband became very ill and unfortunately died. But before he died, he said that they had been abducted, and he remembered the abduction, but he had never told her about it. And so it was like a second abduction by possibly the same UFO at the same time and place, which was weird in itself because usually abductions just take place with one or two people, usually one out in the middle of nowhere. But this might have been an abduction where the first two people reported it, but then later these other two people that were in the same area reported something too. But what was interesting to me was that besides that, I had talked to a number of different people, and I think this was the first instance where there had been a double abduction of separate independent people. But there was another one of that happened also during the 1973 wave. But also at the same time as the Pascagoula abduction, I've talked to a number of people, and other things like abduction happened to them. I mean, for example, there were these people out on an island that was out from Pascagoula, and they were on a dune buggy or whatever, and they got stuck. Well, they were trying to get the dune buggy out, and they couldn't. They were pushing and pulling. And then on the same night as the abduction, this thing flew over and turned its bright lights on them. And they hadn't heard the abduction or anything then, but this thing flew over and turned this real bright light on them. And they said it was so bright you could see the individual grains of sand. Well, they suddenly gained in strength due to terror and adrenaline, and somehow they managed to lift the dune buggy out and get out of there. But it was like some of the sequences that happens with abductions, where first of all there's a light, and then there were a number of other things that happened like that too. For example, there were at that same time there were another group of people traveling from traveling toward New Orleans. They were west of Pascagoula, I forget the cities now, and they were just driving along, happily driving. At the same time as these people experienced the Pascagoula abduction, well, this thing flew over them. This thing came down, flew down. It got right in front of the car, and it was like it was clicking or flashing or something in front of them. And they were driving along. One of them was famous. They were driving along, and suddenly it's like they were just out of it, and they continued driving, and then this thing left, and they started looking at each other and saying, "What happened?" And they seemed all really mixed up. They were planning to go to New Orleans and get in some tournaments, but instead they drove back to Pascagoula and then some other city, and it was a month before they left, and they just seemed confused. And several things like that happened at the same time as the reported abduction. It was like these people were reported being kind of paralyzed, and so did the people that were in the abduction. And they
did missing time.
Yeah, they reported feeling paralyzed, and mm-hmm. And this thing during the abduction, the Pascagoula abduction, they said that this thing seemed to scan them. Well, in this case of these people in the car, this thing seemed to be like taking pictures or looking at them or something. Like it was, and they were some distance away, but it happened the same time. It was like sort of like abductive activity going on at that time. And no formal reported abductions, but it sounded like things were like abductions.
Yeah, but there were, well, you know, any kind of a close encounter is going to be very disorienting in one way or another. And people often, I think more often than we realize, probably have encounters that they don't notice, because the missing time experience is so seamless. I've had missing time right in this apartment, where I could document a 7-minute period of missing time, and there is no sense of anything lost. And so, you know, they could easily have been abducted and they just didn't know it. This was all happening. There's something very operational about this, in the sense that somebody, not us, decided to come here and do this. And they acted on their decision, for whatever reason their coming generated that enormous noise. And then the next thing you know, these abductions and close encounters and strange events start taking place. Which gets me back to the Pascagoula case itself and what they saw when they were aboard the UFO. Can you describe their impression of the being that they saw? Are there more than one? I forget.
There were three. And they were just fishing, happily fishing.
And right. I mean, three beings and two guys, basically.
Yeah, three beings and two people, Calvin and Charles. Calvin Parker and Charles Hickson. They were after their day of work, and they were down in Mississippi, and there was a pier and water. And down in Mississippi, there's lots of water, and it was down by the Pascagoula River, so they were used to, you know, water-type things. And so they went fishing after their day of work. They were just normal people, not interested in UFOs or anything. What they were worried about was the younger man had parked his car in a place with no trespassing. The older man said it's safe to go out. Let's go out and fish. And he was worried about his car. So what they first saw was a blue thing, a blue light. And the younger man immediately worried that this is the police. And he told his friend that, you know, if they pick us up, you can go to jail. You know, he didn't want his nice new car, anything to happen to it. And so it turned out to be a whole lot worse than the police, because this thing came up and it levitated. It didn't have wings or anything. It just levitated up and levitated by him. And it opened up and all this light came out. And then three beings came out. And two of them collected the older man, and one collected the younger man, and took him inside. And the inside was very, very, very bright. They couldn't see anything. And what they saw was, on their first reports, was that the older man said something like an eye came out from the wall, and it seemed to focus, and then it seemed to rotate around him, like it was scanning him. And I mean, this is from their first, there's a whole lot of documents of their first accounts. The younger man said he fainted and didn't remember, but later he he did remember. And so they were nervous about reporting it, because back in 73 or even now, if you said that, everybody would call you crazy and everything. Well, the older man had been in the war. He'd been experienced in life and death situations, and he thought he could take the harassment. The younger man didn't want to talk about anything. But the older man decided we're going to report it, and he did, because he was afraid there might be an invasion or anything else. He didn't know what was going on. He just felt he reported first to Kessler Air Force Base, and they said, we don't do UFOs anymore. Then they told him to report to the police, so he did. Well, the police were skeptical, and they didn't want anybody to make fun of him or make a fool out of him. So they did a real good job of interviewing. They took him together apart, interviewed him separately, then put him room together, interviewed him. Then the interviewer left, and what they were doing was finding out whether these people were hoaxing, because if they were hoaxing and they were in a room by themselves, they would probably be laughing and saying, oh, we really. But instead, the two men were just absolutely terrified now of their mind and about to have a heart attack and die. They were so scared. And so they got a tape recording of that, and that's even on the internet. So that made a real good impression on everybody that these people aren't lying. And that's one reason it was a real strong case, is because whatever happened, the two reporters are very sincere.
Yeah, they were trying hard, and they were scared. I don't blame them. I would be too. In fact, I was. I'll never forget when I realized that it had actually happened, that it was not something in my head or a misapprehension. It was
absolutely. Or now.
Or what?
Or now.
Now, yeah, well, I got past the owl pretty quickly, because as Ann put it very gently the first morning, she said, Whitley, an owl can't get in this house. And that was true. And I'll never forget that evening as the sun set, I went upstairs to the bedroom, and I knew what I would find. It had been snowy, and I remembered the owl looking at me through the bedroom, one of the bedroom windows, and it would have left claw marks on the windowsill. And the sun was setting and the evening was beginning. And I finally got up the guts to go upstairs and look at that windowsill. And there were no claws on that windowsill. And I was very, very scared then. So I really sympathize with people like Calvin and Charles. Let me ask you this. Let's talk about what the alien that they saw looked like, because this has always fascinated me. How did they describe them?
Well, their description was a whole lot different from what was in the literature. They didn't know what's in the literature.
Exactly. That's why it's so interesting to me.
Because, well, it shows that, you know, if they were going to hoax, well, they would look up what an alien looks like and then describe it. Well, what they described is nothing like anybody reported before. And they described it as mechanical, and they seemed to think they were more like machines than people, which, you know, we're going to other planets and machines, but that isn't what people normally report with aliens or whatever they are. They were a lot different from your regular aliens because, like, the grays and things are kind of skinny and big heads and things. Well, these were kind of porky, I mean, big, and but short. They were only about 5 feet tall, but their skin or whatever, their outer covering or whatever, they didn't know if it was skin, but it was something that was sort of reminded them of elephant or something. It was kind of gray. And today's aliens, and a lot of them, have big eyes. Well, these, they didn't even see eyes there. And their head fit on their shoulder, but they had kind of like arms and legs. The legs were like pedestals. They didn't walk around with their legs. Instead, they just moved around by levitation. Their legs were just like two things glued together. Their arms were longer and seemed to have claws. So they didn't look anything. They were kind of opposite of your standard alien.
They sound like machines that were purpose-built. In other words, they were designed to do this, but they weren't like living beings. So that's what interested me so much about this. The idea of this being some kind of an operation, maybe even a military operation, because you know, it begins with this incredibly intimidating, or this not necessarily begins with, but this incredibly intimidating huge sound occurs. And then these people are abducted, and there are obviously other abductions. And I have to wonder if there were many abductions that we never got, that never came to the surface, never, people didn't report them, because God knows, even to this day, most people are not going to necessarily be willing to report something like that. It takes a special kind of person to say to themselves, yeah, this happened to me, and damn it, I'm going to talk about it. Mostly it's going to think, people are going to think, yeah, this happened to me, and I better keep quiet about it, or I'll lose my job, or I'll lose my family, or whatever. So,
well, four people involved in that first abduction. There were Charlie and Calvin, but the other two people were also involved. And Calvin didn't want to speak about it for like 50 years, and the other man didn't speak about it for about 50 years too. So even two out of four didn't want to talk about it, and the woman didn't know what happened. She just remembered, had some memory of something weird happening and a whole lot of fear. So the only one that really talked about it was Charles. And that was because he had had life and death situations, and he thought he could take the harassment. But scientifically, I think you're missing a huge amount of data when you ridicule people and say this can't happen, because scientifically, you shouldn't have your theories telling you what is happening. you should go by the observations and then invent the theories. Well, with UFOs, like they levitate instead of flying like airplanes and things like that, people go through walls and all that. So, the aliens or whatever they are. So everybody says, well, this can't happen. Therefore, all the observations should be thrown away. Well, that's ridiculous because you need to get the observations and study them. I mean, perfectly sane people that aren't having hallucinations are having UFO experiences, and all that stuff should be collected. And if you have people so intimidated, they won't even think about reporting it. You're losing a whole lot of information that you ought to be getting.
I think there's a massive problem there. I think we're losing an enormous amount of information that we should be getting and are not getting. Enormous. And I think it's tragic that because people are intimidated. I mean, they're intimidated more by the society than by the visitors. And they can see what happens to people who go out into the public being ridiculed by the press. Although recently, I have to say that there's been a change in the way the press handles it. It's not so snarky anymore. I know Lou Elizondo has been out with Immanent with his new book in big places like CBS Mornings and, you know, all kinds of major shows. And he's not been attacked at all. He's been, you know, I remember when I went out, oh no, I was beaten up like you would not believe by almost everyone except Johnny Carson. And Johnny didn't beat me up for a very extraordinary reason. He and his wife had been sitting on their deck in Malibu, and a silver UFO had come and circled the house three or four times. And that was why he treated me with respect. And I thought to myself, the visitors are looking out for their guy, because he could have destroyed me on the Tonight Show, and he didn't. And if you look at that, the tape's been taken off of everywhere. I don't know whether it's, you know, it's probably the intelligence community, because they don't want anyone to seem to look at me reasonably. But in any case, Calvin and Charles went through it too. They've had a hell of a time after this. Or those poor kids who saw the Flatwoods Monster were ridiculed almost to the point of suicide. And yet it goes on, Irina. It goes on now. And people are still scared. Let's get back to your book. And you know, the interesting thing, a book is basically about the feminine origins of human society. And we're talking about now an experience that has a very feminine underpinning to it. The whole Close Encounter experience is a very powerful female presence seems to be coming into our world. Is this a harbinger of change? Are we going to return to a matriarchal society, Irina? Do you think that might be what this is about?
Well, you think of being in control of society as being in power. And now with our male orientation, we think of, you know, coming in and, you know, using weapons, killing people, taking over with power and all that. And they always say, well, the control of society is due to power. Well, maybe it's not due to power. I mean, power is like life and death, and like Darwin's survival of the fittest, like there's two entities and one kills the other when they survive. Well, I was giving a example of if survival of the fittest, and you know, if you take two things like yellow and blue, and one kills the other one, you've got one left, and you've got shades of blue, and that's it. That's power. One has power over the other one. If you have yellow and blue instead of that survival of the fittest and competition, all that, you have coordination and work together. Well, you can get yellow and blue and green. And that's what evolution is. Evolution in Earth, anyway, is toward more complexity. With more complexity, you get that by working together, like the human body is made out of all kinds of cells. And so I was saying that maybe instead of power, that society and life itself is more organized by cooperation, which is in animals, that's females. I mean, like a lion group, a lion pride, the females aren't fighting each other. The males are fighting each other to get in, but the females get along together. And usually in different groups, it's the males that do the fighting.
Yeah, that's right. That's very true in most animal societies as well. We do fight, and we're full of testosterone to get us doing that. And we're in a world that's basically too crowded for fighting, and we can't do it anymore. We got to find a way out, another way. And that's why I think that the whole process of government over the next 50 years or so is going to change and become much more protective and embracing than it is now, and much less warlike, and in a sense much more feminine, because it has to, otherwise we're going to die here. I want to get back to, we just touched on this, the idea of there being a kind of harbinger of the future here in the fact that the non-human presence is feminine in its disposition, and I guess in its origin, because when you're with the visitors any length of time, you're never, very rarely with males. You're always with women. And it seems like the active element in their society is the feminine. And are we looking at an ancient form of human being, perhaps, or something that was connected to us in the distant past? Is that what these eye goddesses are, that we see, the goddesses with the big eyes of Julian James that he made such a point of in his book? Was that them then, do you think, or not?
Well, I was sort of explaining it in evolution that people are primates. We see things in 3D. And so our very first idea, sign of our thinking process, was statues, the carvings that were made way, way back. And I was saying that if people can make carvings, they can picture something in symbols, so they can symbolize themselves. And then that goes in, that ability to symbolize is what turns into like art and language and thinking in symbols, and that's our strength, is that. I don't know. I was explaining an evolution, but I was just saying that we can symbolize ourselves and see ourselves from the outside. That might be more female than male, because the female has to protect the next generation instead of just looking out for herself and fighting the next, you know, somebody else as a competitor. The female doesn't do that. She defends the young. And that ability to see yourself from the outside might be a big component of whatever human consciousness is. And it's maybe a lot more tied to our evolution than killing animals with rocks and things like that. I didn't answer your question because I don't know.
You touched the question. You circled it, and that's fine. We allow question circling here. Oh. But you know, when you think about it, though, where we are now, we recently had, and are still having, in fact, as of the recording of this, although it will be gone by the time the show is up, a temperature spike in the stratosphere above the Antarctic, reaching around 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, that's not at the surface, but it's a very, very unusual phenomenon that is going to affect the planet's weather, especially in the southern hemisphere, profoundly. What it's going to do is going to push a lot of the cold air out into the regions around it, and cause extremely cold weather in Australia and the southern half of South America and New Zealand. And what is so bizarre is we're dealing with a major warning from nature there. That's a major warning. It's a very important warning. And what are we fixated on? We're fixated on wars in the Middle East, Vladimir Putin playing 19th century czar and trying to use his gimcrack army to expend and restore the old Russian Empire. We're living in fantasy land, a fantasy land we cannot afford to live in. And the visitors seem to be waiting in the wings, and maybe they're waiting for us to wake up, and maybe they're not. Maybe they're waiting for us to become so helpless that we have nowhere to turn except to them. And I think that is what they're waiting for, by the way. And I'm not sure we're going to be too happy when that happens.
Well,
Irina, go ahead, please.
Not only is there the possibility of destroying ourselves with our weapons, but we're expending all this energy and time making weapons and solving things by violence. That, I mean, we may be out in the, I mean, if we weren't spending all that time doing that and energy, we might be out in the universe ourselves, you know, and have eternal life and everything else. I mean, who knows? But instead, we're developing weapons and killing things.
And we haven't gotten beyond the jet and the rocket. And we have flitting around us all over the place objects that are far beyond that. We know that these types of propulsion and so forth exist. We know someone can come here from the outside. And what do we do with our energy and our intelligence? We build better tanks and better planes. Come on, guys. Okay, we've come to the end of our time together on Dreamland. It's been a great show, as always, Irina. Fascinating discussion, and thank you very much for being with us. Irina's book is Alien, The Aliens and the Apocalypse. You can get it from the unknowncountry.com store. You can get it from Amazon or probably from your local bookstore if you have one, and I hope you do. And you can visit Irina at irinascott.com. That's irinascott.com. Thank you very much for supporting Dreamland, all of you, and Unknown Country. And I'm looking forward to seeing you next week. Thank you for being with us, Irina.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate everything you do.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.